thank you very much
for that introduction. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about some issues on classical simulation also that sort of arise from considerations of graph theory, in particular the theory of perfect matchings in graphs and Valiant's theory of match gates and so-called holographic algorithms, which in fact Martin has already nicely mentioned and given some background on. So that's very helpful. And the results I'll be talking about are joint work with Akimasa Miyake, who is also here. And in fact, our paper appeared on the archive today. So I don't think I've ever achieved such excellent timing before. But okay, so to begin, I want to give a little bit of background about the graph theoretic ideas involved, but then I'll sort of not use them later on, but they're sort of so interesting. I think they're certainly worth a look at. So this idea of perfect matchings in a graph, so suppose you have a graph, like here's a simple graph with, you know, the square with these five edges, and a perfect matching is simply a set of edges that uses each vertex exactly once. So for example, the two blue lines, A and D, are a perfect matching, and so are the two greenish ones. But this sort of brownish line cannot be extended to a perfect matching, because then you can't get the other two vertices in any way without reusing these twice. Okay, so that's what a perfect matching is. And given a graph, it's interesting to ask, does it have a perfect matching? And how many perfect matchings does it have? And these are sort of fundamentally interesting questions in many contexts. And it's known that the existence to decide whether there is a perfect matching is easy. There's a polynomial time algorithm. But to count how many there are is extremely hard. It's so-called sharp P hard. And sharp P is this complexity class, which is much bigger than NP. So it's much harder than anything in NP, for example. So it's a very significant thing. However, if the graph is a planar graph, like this one, you can draw it on a plane without any edge crossing each other, then there's this remarkable algorithm that can count the number of perfect matchings in polynomial time. Now, people always talk about these planarity conditions and planar graphs, but that's a bit of a slightly misleading, because the kinds of graphs for which you can do this in polynomial time are not just planar. There's this rather complicated technical condition on the graph, and planar graphs happen to be examples of that. So there's nothing sort of mysteriously marvelous about planarity, unfortunately, it seems. But nevertheless, you know, we like planar graphs. And so more generally, we can weight our graphs, we can put numbers on the edges and define this so-called match sum, where you take any perfect matching and multiply the weights and then add it up over all perfect matching. So here it would be AD plus BE would be this thing for that graph. And of course, if the weights are all one, this thing just counts how many perfect matchings there are. And this Fisher-Castellane-Temperley remarkable algorithm can compute this thing in polynomial time for a planar graph. Okay, so, and it does it by computing this thing that's called a Pfaffian of an antisymmetric matrix. And I'm not going to even define what that is, because we won't need it. But think of it as being like a determinant. In fact, it amounts to the square root of the determinant. So based on all this, Valiant came up with this ingenious scheme of match gates and so-called holographic algorithms. So what's a match gate? Well, roughly, this is sort of only intuitive. I've left out some of the more sort of messy details to make it all work really properly. But a match gate is a thing of the following sort. You start with a graph like we had, and you designate some of its vertices as inputs and some as output vertices. Just pick some, particularly around the edges. And then you write down this sort of indexed object, this tensor with an index, a zero or one valued index for each input, which I'll write up there and outputs down there. And you def for any association of zeros and ones to these indices, you take the value of this thing to be this match sum thing we just had on the graph obtained by omitting all those nodes where the indices are one. And you omit all the edges that are incident on them as well. Okay, so for each component of this tensor can be computed in polynomial time if G is a planar graph, but there are lots of them, obviously. And so if we now consider circuits of these tensors, that sort of amounts to like contractions over these indices. And with a little bit of thought, you can see that it corresponds to computing this this match sum for a larger graph, namely the graph obtained by gluing together all the small graphs associated to all the separate tensors, where you glue them according to the indices you contract. And then this idea of contracting matrix indices sort of combines neatly with this sum of products here to show that the result of this contraction is just computing one of these things on this bigger graph. Roughly speaking, there's a few other signs and things you need to include here. So therefore, the contraction is polytime computable too. And this is sort of Valiant's fundamental theorem that you can compute in polynomial time these contractions of these rather big tensors. Okay, so sometimes these objects here turn out to be unitary operations if m equals n. So you'll have sort of n qubits, an operation on n qubits. And so in that case, this whole formalism boils down to a way of computing in polynomial time a certain contraction of unitary gates, which is therefore simulating a quantum circuit. Okay, and that's sort of how we make a connection to sort of quantum circuits from this formalism of perfect matchings on graphs. Now, and then finally, just roughly speaking, these so-called holographic algorithms, well, so Valiant wants to exploit this polytime computability of this object by reducing other problems to computing such contractions. And these are these so-called holographic algorithms. And I think he says in some of his papers that he was motivated, in fact, by quantum computing to invent this thing. Because these Pfaffians in that algorithm I mentioned at the beginning are on the face of it exponentially big sums. It's a bit like if you have a determinant, you know, of an n by n matrix. If you write it all out, it's got n factorial terms in it, which is exponentially big, bigger than exponential all that. But nevertheless, we can compute it in polynomial time, which is a remarkable thing. You know, if you imagine taking the matrix and doing like a Gaussian elimination on it, you imagine what that Gaussian elimination is doing to this exponentially big sum. It's kind of manipulating exponential stuff in each of our little steps, and exponential cancellations occur, and after just a few steps, we've got the whole thing worked out. And this is just like what happens in quantum computing with exponentially many amplitudes interfering and being manipulated by applying sort of local gates. But here, there's nothing quantum. These are all just classical polytime algorithms, and he was able to generate interesting new polytime algorithms for some problems. Okay, so that's all that sort of classical stuff there. So we have this theory of perfect matchings, which was associated to these funny things called Pfaffians. But as, in fact, Martin mentioned, it's been known for a long time that in fact, the same mathematical animals occur in fermionic physics. So they sort of come up in these two different things. So of course, I guess it's natural to think that there might be some relation, or at least some translation of problems between these two very disparate looking things. And soon after Valiant's work, in about 2000, I think it came out, Manny Knill and Tahal and DiVincenzo sorted out a nice relationship between these things and showed indeed that you can interpret Valiant's results in terms of suitable fermionic, free fermionic constructions. And then Bravi developed this fermionic formalism a lot more afterwards. Okay, so let me just go straight. So that's the end of the graph theory, and now we can get down to some quantum circuits. So I want to begin by stating, roughly speaking, what Valiant's classical simulation of quantum circuits amounts to. This is not exactly Valiant's theorem. It's slightly more restrictive in some ways, but slightly more general in other ways. Okay, but this is the form I want to discuss here. So consider two qubit gates, GAB, of this form, and I'll be using this notation a lot throughout, so you should remember what these gates look like. And in fact, Martin's already written these things down. So they're two qubit gates with four non-zero entries on the corners and four in the middle, and the outer four form a matrix A and the inner four a matrix B, and we require A and B to be both in SU2 or U2 with the same determinant. Okay, we don't allow them to have different determinants. And so intuitively, or you know, you can interpret these things very simply as it's the gate A acting in the even parity subspace and the gate B in the odd parity subspace. Okay, but just because a block diagonalizes doesn't mean it's sort of simple when you start putting these things together. So the basic theorem is the following. Consider any poly-sized circuit of these gates at all with following conditions. The gates are allowed to act only on nearest neighbor lines. Okay, these two qubit gates, but you're only allowed to apply them to consecutive lines. The input is allowed to be any product state. It's sort of something we can easily get rather than just computational basis state. And I'm only going to consider final output measurements on a single line rather than across all the lines. Okay, so it's like a decision problem. You just have zero, one. No, okay. No. We'll come, so I'll emphasize that in a moment. That's a crucial point. Yeah. Okay, so yes, we'll talk about swaps in the next slide, I think. So you've got these conditions, and then the output can be classically efficiently simulated. And I won't translate that into Dutch. Well, what do I mean by classically efficiently simulated? I mean it not only that, but it's in an extremely strong sense. So more precisely, we can compute the output, we can compute the expectation value of Z, which amounts to the difference of the probabilities. So therefore, we can compute the probabilities to k digits of accuracy in poly nk time. So we get exponential precision in polynomial time, 1 over 2 to the k. Very, very strong condition for classical simulability, which we would normally perhaps only ask for being able to sample this probability distribution up to some accuracy once. You know, this is enormously more strong. So I want to give a proof of this theorem, or outline how proof goes, which is sort of based on the fermionic formalism, although I'm not going to use fermionic language at all. And perhaps this nearest neighbor condition coming from the quantum circuit side is a bit mysterious. It's not the sort of thing you normally have a restriction on. And then I want to discuss some further generalizations and significance of this theorem. Okay, so I want to emphasize here non-nearest neighbor use of these gates is definitely not allowed. And indeed, as Jens just mentioned, the swap operation is not one of these guys, but in fact the swap operation is GIX, because the swap just interchanges 0, 1, and 1, 0, but leaves these guys the same. So it is like a GAB, but the determinants are different. Just, determinant of x is minus 1. And it's just that single minus sign that prevents the swap from being in there. But on the other hand, GZX is allowed, because they've got the same determinant. And you can factorize into these two things, which is just our familiar control Z and swap. So you've got a kind of a swap, but then you've got to do a control Z to go with it, which is sort of fermionic, if you like, fermionic physics. So now the significance of swap is very crucial here, because it was known, in fact, already in the work of Tahal and DiVincenzo, or they refer to some previous work, that if you allow these GAB gates to act on arbitrary lines, it's universal for quantum computing. So in particular, GAB with swap is universal. But what I want to prove, if I get round to it, if there's time, is a rather strong condition that these gates acting not just on nearest neighbor, but only next nearest neighbor. So if you go from that situation to that situation only, is already efficiently universal for quantum computing. So now this is rather perhaps disconcerting to many people, because we hear all this, many people claim that the power of quantum computing comes from entanglement. You know, in fact, I might have said that myself at some point. And so therefore it's probably true in a sense, you know. But from this point of view, an extremely modest use of an apparently trivial resource of just swapping two qubit lines is enough to bridge the gap from classically simulatable things to full quantum computational power. So, and the swap, we don't even use it arbitrarily. We're not even allowed to swap things more than one single distance further. Yeah.
Entangling power of all is the swap, right?
Yeah, well. I guess if you want to generate more complicated space, you really need to use more swap system layers and so on. But I mean, well, yeah, maybe there's a little bit. But anyhow, yeah.
So swap actually can create entanglement. I mean, if you have two EPRs, yeah, and you swap. Yeah. So actually, it does. It could create.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So
you were right.
There are other ways. We all agree that it's swap that gives quantum computing its power. So don't talk to me about complexity of entanglement. So we don't need all that sort of stuff.
So now I want to sort of run through the ingredients for proof. Now, yeah.
What will be the general condition you impose on the matrices in the B?
Well, I simply allow these gates.
Arbitrary in B.
With the same determinant, yeah.
But same the determinant.
Yeah, but that determinant can vary in different GABs.
I see. So
but it's only an overall phase, you know, so.
Can we claim that for such a n of b's, you have a perfect matching gate graph? What's the relation?
These gates are precisely the match gates with two input and two outputs that are unitary.
All right.
Yeah. So that's, I should mention that's the connection. So this proof sort of follows the fermionic constructions that I guess were perhaps first laid out by Carl and David DiVincenzo. But I think fermions are a bit of a red herring, really, because a lot of people are afraid of fermions because they have weird, sort of apparently non-local sort of effects. And in fact, the fermionic interpretation of these results seems to play no role whatsoever in the fact that they're fermions is irrelevant. It's the underlying mathematics that's important, and it can be sort of expressed in a way that doesn't really relate immediately to fermions, although of course you can turn it around for that. Okay, so here we start with sort of fermionic looking things. We have, for n qubit lines, you start with a bunch of operators A, 1 up to AN, which satisfy these anti-commutation relations, which are in fact the fermionic relations, but let's not mention the word fermion. But I want to instead introduce these two N operators, which are called Cs, which are just the Hermitian and anti-Hermitian parts of those As. And so that's just a bunch of two N Hermitian operators. And because of these relations, they satisfy these relations, which are just the relations for a mathematical Clifford algebra on two N generators. So I want to view this as basic, which needn't have anything to do with fermions, you know, although of course they occur in free fermionic physics. So I just want to study some mathematics of this algebraic structure.
So the first thing you notice is because, you know, they all square to the identity and they anti-commute, they're different, then if I consider the algebra generated by all products of these things and sums of such, then it forms a, any element can be written in this form, because if two C's are the same, they just annihilate each other. So you just have linear combinations of monomials in the C's where I1 up to IK are ordered and all different. Okay, so there's 2 to the n such things corresponding to all the subsets of 2n things. Sorry, 2 to the 2n subsets of such things. And one can easily see that they're all linearly independent, and this algebra forms a vector space of that dimension. So if you're going to have a matrix representation of such a thing, it has to have matrices at least of this size in order to get this many linearly independent ones. So they're like n qubit sized operations. So now, the basic result on which the whole classical simulation thing hangs is nothing really to do with fermions or physics even. It's just a mathematical result of the following thing. So we introduce so-called quadratic Hamiltonians. So these are simply quadratic elements of our algebra, which are Hermitian. So since they anti-commute and it's Hermitian, without loss of generality, this matrix of coefficients here is a 2n by 2n anti-symmetric real matrix. One can just impose that without loss of generality. And then, given any such thing, we can exponentiate it. We can form u, which is e to the ih, where the exponential is simply defined by the power series, you know, just compute power series in the algebra. Then the remarkable theorem is the following. Suppose I've got such a gate, which we'll call sometimes a Gaussian operation because of its quadratic Hamiltonian nature. If you transform the basic generators, the C's, by conjugation under this thing, then they only transform into a linear combination of the C's. So this kind of linear degree one elements of the algebra, where the coefficient matrix here is in fact a rotation. It's a 2n by 2n rotation, SO2n. In fact, it's just the exponential of this anti-symmetric matrix up here. Now, so it's very easy to prove this, although you find some rather complicated proofs in the literature. It only takes about 3 lines to prove, as we'll see on the next slide. But the main significance, this a priori is a very remarkable thing, because look, if you look at this thing, it's e to the ih, and h is this thing. So if you compute this exponential, you've got all the c's get multiplied together. So this u is an exponentially big object. It's some great big polynomial in the whole algebra. And so when you conjugate this thing, you could finish up with some object that not only has linear terms, but has everything. It could have 2 to the 2n terms in it. But remarkably, you don't get that. You only get these guys. So you stay in a polynomially small size part of an exponentially big algebra. And that's really the key thing that makes it all work. So perhaps I'll avoid sort of proving too many things. But anyhow, to prove this result is very easy. You just do this and this and this, and that's it. Okay, so you can look at the paper maybe. Basically, it's easier to descend back to the infinitesimal level and work there rather than trying to work with these u directly, which people often seem to do. Okay, so having got this result, how are we going to exploit this in to get simulatable circuits? So what we're going to do is, so now we're going to move away from just the Clifford algebra itself and look at a representation, a matrix representation of n qubit Hermitian operators. So given any such representation for the C's, when we look at arbitrary quadratic Hamiltonians, and they'll give us a class of n qubit unitary gates. And if M is any circuit of these so-called Gaussian gates, if you have an input state and you apply it, you get some output state, then if you compute the expectation value of these C's, so now you remember they're they're Hermitian operators on n qubits. They're still great big things, but we'll come more precisely to what they could be in a moment. So you compute this expectation value, well, it's just this usual thing, and the m conjugate m just hits the c mu in the middle, and then we use our theorem to recall that this is just turns into a linear combination of c's by some coefficients, which are those rotations in 2n dimensions from all the separate gates in this circuit. You just multiply them together as matrices, which is easy to do in poly time. It's a poly-sized circuit. So we get this expression, therefore, for the expectation value of this thing. Well, this is still rather hard to compute, because remember, these things are now matrices of size 2 to the n. They're n qubit sized things. So this is exponentially big computation. But if the input state is a product state, and if the representation we chose by good management were product operators on n qubits, then all of these computations just break down into n individual computations. They're n qubits. So n qubit product states, n qubit product operators, everything's polytime computable, and we get this expectation value in polynomial time. Okay, so, but of course, all these C's, we're not really interested in these C's. We want the Z's, you know, that's the output expectation value for this guy. So, for example, Z1, if we measure the first line. Well, so coming back to our Clifford algebra, I sort of mentioned that it was 2 to the n by 2 to the n dimensional. So therefore, it spans all matrices. Any matrix can be written as some combination of products of C, monomials in C. So therefore, this Z that we're interested in must be some polynomial in these representation matrices. So it's a question of how many monomials you've got in that sum. How big is that polynomial going to be? Well, if the degree is bounded, independent of n, then everything still stays polynomially computable. So for example, suppose Z1 was just C1 times C2, for sake of argument. Then the expectation value of Z1 on the output state is just given by this, m dagger C1, C2, m. So we just slip in there an m dagger and regroup these things. So C1's conjugated and C2's conjugated. So it's just like this sum we had here before, but now we've got two of these things going together, and we get a sum not over order n things, but order n squared because of this quadratic expression here, or be order n to the d if this was degree d. So, and if the c's were product operators, these are still product operators, and they have product states, so everything is still polytime computable, and it all goes through just fine. Okay, so we can compute the things we want as well, if all of these little things happen to work out for us. Okay, so, and indeed they do, or can be made to by good choice. So now we want to talk about an explicit representation of this Clifford algebra on n qubits. So we want n qubit Hermitian matrices to represent these things. And there's this famous Jordan-Bigner representation, which is defined as follows. You take the x and the y powers in slot 1 for C1 and C2, and then you put them in slot 2 for the next pair, but you put z's on the left side and i's on the right side, and for the kth pair here, you put them in the kth slot, and z's all the way up here and i's all the way down there. Okay, so it's a slightly odd thing if you haven't seen it before, but the virtue of these definitions is it's very easy to check that it really is a representation of the algebra we want, because it satisfies these anti-commutation relations that we want. Not the fermionic ones, but you've got this, they square to the identity. And furthermore, the ZK in this representation does indeed correspond to this quadratic expression. Because you see, if you multiply, you know, these two things together, you get the Z in that slot, and all these Z's disappear on you, so you just get that single Z left. So hence, for this particular explicit representation of the algebra, the expectation value of the output probabilities are computable in polynomial time for any product state input and any poly-sized circuit of these particular kinds of gates arising from Hermitian quadratic elements in the algebra. So that's all very well, but then the question is, well, what are these? You know, what do they actually look like? And it's probably no surprise that we'll regain the Valiant result. So first look at just the first two qubit lines, 1 and 2. So there are 6 quadratic things, 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 3, 2, 4, 3, 4, and so on. And if you work out what they all are, they're just these guys here with identities, you know, everywhere else. So you say, well, what is the exponential of a general combination of these things? So it's our general Gaussian gate on the first two qubit lines. Well, it's very easy to see without any calculation at all, because you simply notice that these gates, they all preserve the even and odd parity subspaces, because if you flip a 0 to a 1, you do it here as well. So they all block diagonalize relative to these two subspaces. They're all trace-free. There's 6 parameters worth. You have to get unitary things. So the only thing you can possibly get is SU2 and SU2 in those two subspaces. But you can spend a few pages doing that more explicitly if you want, but it's kind of unnecessary. Right? So it's perfectly clear that on lines 1 and 2, you get precisely the Valiant GAB gates out of this formalism. And similarly, for any other consecutive pair of lines, you get the Valiant GAB gate consecutively. So, and I'll say something in a moment about non-consecutive lines. So, okay, so that's all very well, and this is the end of the proof of Valiant's theorem, but we seem to have proved much more here, because these are only very special quadratic Hamiltonians that use only 6 of these quadratic terms associated to nearest neighbor lines. What about all the other, you know, all the other C's multiplied together, C1, C10, and, you know, C2, C15, and so on. So there seem to be not on nearest neighbor lines. So there seem to be loads of other gates we can simulate as well. So what are they? So basically, the Valiant nearest neighbor gates. So here we see the significance of nearest neighbor being a bit of a red herring as well in the theorem, because nearest neighbor gates of Valiant are just part of a larger set of gates that can act on any number and more distant qubit lines, these general quadratic Hamiltonians. but in that set of gates, so there is nothing really significant about nearest neighbor, but the point is the GAB gates themselves acting on not nearest neighbors are not in that set. So you can't use those gates and act on distant lines, but there are other gates that act on distant lines. So notice that you can't just, suppose I have a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, and here I've gone back to the A's because they correspond directly to line 1 and line 2. So if you have that quadratic term and you replace it by line 1 and line 3, then the important point is you don't get, and then you exponentiate these things, you don't get the same, so this gives a certain gate on lines 1 and 2, you don't get the same gate on lines 1 and 3 from this. Because if, for example, you look at this thing, C2 and C4, which is X1, Y2 in the Jordan-Wigner representation, from lines 1 and 2, if I shift the C4 into a C6, which is the same thing for lines 1 and 3, there's this initial string of Z's. So you get X1 and Y3, but this Z pops up in between. So now when you exponentiate this, you don't get the same gate as that acting on lines 1 and 3. So that GAB gate doesn't appear. So indeed, you get some gate acting on all 3 lines non-trivially. So what about all these more general gates then? Why can't we just extend Valiant's theorem and get a rather more broad-ranging result? Well, it turns out he has, in fact, captured everything you can get in the following sense. Suppose I take the most general quadratic Hamiltonian involving everything you can think of and stick it all in with these general coefficients, then you get some great big unitary operation on n qubits, which we can classically simulate, But in fact, it doesn't give you anything new, because any such most general object is always a circuit, can always be expressed as a circuit of nearest neighbor valiant gates. Okay, so in this context of circuits, it doesn't produce anything more interesting for you. And indeed, the translation from this global n qubit unitary to this circuit of these local things can be computed efficiently, and it's an exact correspondence. It's not like an asymptotic expansion like the usual, you know, Lee Trotter type commutators and so on. There's none of that. And it's efficient as well. If you have an n qubit u, you get about order n cube sized circuit, never any bigger than n cube sized circuit. Okay, so perhaps I won't go through the proof of that, but this essential ingredient is simply to note that any such big U corresponds to a rotation in 2n dimensions, as we saw before, under this conjugation action. And then we take that rotation and decompose it into its Euler angles, a sequence of rotations that act non-trivially only on two-dimensional subspaces. And based on that decomposition, we can readily get this theorem. Okay, but so it's sort of interesting that we get this decomposition, which is exact and efficient for these particular kind of gates. So you're not mentioning that. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about Clifford algebras, and in quantum computing or quantum information theory, one doesn't normally talk about Clifford algebras. We talk about Clifford operations, which are completely different things. And apart from the name Clifford, they don't have really very much to do with each other. So recall, you know, a Clifford operation was simply something that conjugates a product of Pauli's, like an n qubit operation. It's a unitary n qubit thing that conjugates Pauli's into another product of Pauli's for any product of Pauli, the so-called normalizer of the Pauli group in the unitary group. Okay, so that's a Clifford operation, and our Clifford algebra are things that satisfy these anti-commutation relations. And we're particularly interested in sort of product representations of these things. And remember, we've just been talking about this Jordan-Vigna representation of the Clifford algebra, but by good management or great luck, the Jordan-Vigna representation is not only a bunch of product operators, but they're Pauli products. They're all products of Pauli operators. So therefore, you can throw all these things together and get some generalizations of the valiant type simulation results. So the first thing you notice is that if you've got a bunch of matrices satisfying these anti-commutation relations, if you conjugate by any unitary, then you still will have, okay? You get kind of unitarily equivalent representation of the algebra, if you like. And remember, our whole classical simulation result relied on this nice quadratic Hamiltonian property, which in turn rested only on this algebraic relation, plus the product structure of the Jordan-Vigna representation and these product state inputs to go with it to get the final classical simulability. And Clifford operations, if you conjugate here by a Clifford operation rather than any old U, you preserve both of these things. You preserve the Clifford algebra relations and you preserve the product structure of the representation. So therefore, we can play the whole game with this new representation for any n qubit Clifford operation and get new classes of classically simulatable circuits. Well, first thing one should note is that when you take quadratic Hamiltonians and exponentials of these new things, these T conjugations come outside the quadratics and they come outside the whole exponential sum, and the new gates we're going to get are simply the old ones we had before conjugated by the Clifford operation we're using. Okay, so they are sort of somehow related, but they're still genuinely different. They're not expressible in terms of the original valiant gates. So, but we want a few more conditions. We also wanted the output observable, this ZK, to have a bounded polynomial degree in the representation. So previously it was quadratic, but for general Clifford operation conjugation, this will not generally be preserved, and this could turn into a very complicated thing of degree order n, which just gets worse and worse with bigger circuits. And we also want our circuits to be made up of some nice little gates, like nearest neighbor things or whatever, rather than just having these great big n qubit gates we can simulate arbitrarily. And again, for example, we might require the Valiant gates on consecutive lines to conjugate into some local gate on some, say, three lines or four lines or whatever, because general conjugation by Clifford operations will turn even these little gates into great big n qubit things. So we have to be a little bit careful in how we choose these Clifford operations, but it's interesting to note that apart from varying as a function of n, the number of qubit lines input, that they needn't be sort of translationally symmetric across the lines. They needn't be some kind of regular pattern. Whereas the GAB gates did have as a class, they were kind of, you know, sort of structurally translationally symmetric across the lines. Out of this construction, we can get classically simulatable circuits that have a rather peculiar feature that different gates are allowed on different sets of lines in the circuit. You can't use the gates wherever you want. And another observation is that since the new gates are simply conjugates of the old ones, when you stick them all together, these T's and T daggers annihilate each other, and there's only a T left at the front and a T dagger at the end, so we can think of these new circuits, alternatively, as the same as the good old Valiant ones, but the input states are now not product states. It's a Clifford operation on an arbitrary product state, which is now a certain class of entangled states, and the final measurement is not just Z, but it's the conjugation of Z by T. So this is a kind of a generalization to sort of entangled inputs and output measurements. So far, you know, we've looked at a few examples of such T's, but the details are sort of too messy to write down. There's nothing that sort of leaps out at you as being sort of nice, and so I won't write any down here. But I've got a little bit of time left, and I want to go back to this universality proof that these gates acting on nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor are now universal for quantum computing. So before I do that, I want to prove something slightly weaker, that nearest neighbor, and next next nearest neighbor. So I'm going to allow myself one more distant action there. So I'll prove that they're universal, and then indicate how to knock off the last next there. So the first observation is, given any poly-sized quantum circuit at all, we can assume that it's made up of nearest neighbor controlled Zs and one qubit gates. Okay, it's well known to be universal. So I'm going to recode all the input zeros and ones as double zeros and double ones. Now, this is a good thing to do because we know our Valiant gates, even if they're acting on distant lines, they preserve the even and odd parity subspaces. Whereas arbitrary quantum circuits don't. So this is a way of kind of imposing the parity constraint. So everything's going to stay even. So when I suitably encode the gate operations of the circuit, I'm going to stay within the 0, 0, 1, 1 subspaces of all line pairs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. Okay, so my original single qubits are now encoded into pairs of lines. So on any such pair, how do I do a one qubit gate and a controlled Z gate? Well, the one qubit gate A is easy. It's just GAA, because remember, you know, this does A in the even parity and the odd parity. But I'm never even going to use the odd parity subspace. We never go there, because we start even and we'll stay even. So this easily does our A. And so it suffices to show how to do controlled Z on a nearest neighbor pair, for example, 1, 2, and 3, 4. And that's very easy too. So here they are. And you notice that if I just do a controlled Z across 2, 3, sort of the overlapping pair there, then that's going to do the trick for me, because, you know, controlled Z will map a 1, 1 in the middle to a minus sign, regardless of what's on 1 and 4, X and Y, but all the other things left stay the same. So therefore, if we're working on our encoded pairs 1, 1s or 0, 0s, if you know X and Y happen to be equal to what's in the middle, then this will precisely do the controlled Z on the encoded even subspaces that I want. Okay, so we get that. And then we finally notice that controlled Z, which is GZI, it's one of these G gates, I can write it, I want to turn it into a swap now. So we first of all, we turn Z's into X's with Hadamards, and then I want this as IX, not XI, so I can turn it around by just throwing in another XX, putting it around the other way. Because, you know, when you multiply these G gates, you just multiply the corresponding slots. So therefore, this control Z on 2, 3 can be achieved as follows. These are three valid valiant gates of the sort we're allowed to use, but in the middle of them, there's this swap. So here's a picture of how you do the control Z on my two encoded things. And now you notice, so now suppose I've got a whole lot of these things in a circuit with extra, you know, GAAs across maybe here and here and so on, the whole thing, and then I can pull all of my swaps out at the end. But notice the swaps only ever work on the overlaps, 2, 3, or 4, 5, and so on. I never get a swap on 3, 4, so you never get ladders of swaps. So when I pull all these swaps out, you just get these in-between lines toggling back and forth, and no line ever moves more than distance 1 from where it was initially. So therefore, no line ever moves more than distance 1, so the two ends of the GAB gates that were nearest neighbors in that whole circuit can never get beyond next nearest neighbor. At very worst, the two ends can move in opposite directions, one further apart, but never any more than that. So that proves that simulation result. And then to knock off the last next in the next, you use a more clever quadruple rather than a duplicate encoding. You take this encoding. So basically, instead of using 0, 0, 1, 1, you stick two zeros in the middle just to separate them out. So. And one can easily see that this circuit implements the A gate, a 1-qubit gate in this encoding, and as before, the control Z is on nearest neighbor sort of quadruples is exactly as before. Okay, it's easy to verify. It's just a control Z on the overlapping pair, but now these swap lines, I've moved these things apart, so now the two swaps, this one or this one, can never move both ends of a single nearest neighbor GAB gate. Only one end can be moved, or the other end can be moved, but not the middle ends. So you can never get to the next situation. You can only get to the next situation, and so hence we've proved our result. So finally, of course, the key question now is, can we knock off that next as well? I mean, given that these guys are classically simulatable, is it conceivable that this modest use of swap could be classically simulatable too? You know, horror. Yes and no. So first of all, can we even conceive that this might be true? So first of all, recall that, you know, BQP, which is our usual model for quantum efficient computation, the output probabilities have this further constraint of being bounded away from a half. So I guess people usually use 2/3 and 1/3, but I use 3/4 and 1/4 because it's easier to calculate how far away from a half they are. So now introduce this new class, PQP, not BQP, but PQP, which is a kind of quantum analog of PP, this classical class PP, which I won't define, although some of you, many probably know. So now I'm going to relax this condition that on all computational-based inputs, I'm not going to require that the output probabilities be bounded with daylight in between them and half, but I'm going to allow them to get really close to a half, but still to be bigger than a half plus 1 over 2 to the n, or half minus 1 over 2 to the n the other way. Okay, so I don't get this sort of constant gap anymore, and this gap is allowed to shrink exponentially on bigger input size. This is just like you have for PP classically. Now, it's a moment's, well, very little thought shows that this class obviously contains classical PP and NP, okay, are in here. So now introduce a subset of these PQP things. They're the languages for which have circuits of this form, with this very loose requirement on probabilities. So they have circuits of this. So if you're in the language, you have to have that probability slightly bigger than a half. And if you're not in the language, you have to be rejected by that sort of probability. Okay, so introduce the subclass of such languages where the circuit is not only a general such thing, but it's actually one made up of nearest neighbor GAB gates. Okay, so the Valiant theorem tells us that these guys are actually in P, classical P, because we can compute the probabilities to exponential accuracy, so we can tell which of these two things happens on any input by computing the probability to n binary places, and then we know for sure whether we're in or out. So that's deterministic classical polynomial time. And the universality theorem we just had says that although this is the case, the whole class PQP can actually be represented as nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor GAB circuits. So therefore, if this passage to next nearest neighbor can be achieved while maintaining classical simulatability in this strong sense of computing probabilities, then since we have this thing happening, it would follow that P equals NP equals PP, which would be a good thing, which would simplify a lot of stuff, wouldn't it? But I guess most people probably think it's fairly implausible, although unproven, of course. Okay, so this indicates that it looks as though an extra quantum computational power must be attributable to this tiny addition of, you know, ability for these gates just to act one line further apart, unless this horrendous thing happens, you know, which no one would believe happens. However, we can now play the same game not with PQP, but with BQP, because, you know, BQP is contained in here, because this is a much more stringent condition. Obviously, this implies this, but this is much, much stronger, and there are far fewer of these things, it seems. So we can sort of ask similar questions there. But the same argument for BQP is rather less compelling, because it's generally believed that NP and PP are not in BQP. So if the passage from nearest neighbor to next nearest neighbor such circuits was achievable with classical simulability for BQP circuits, it would not imply this implausible thing. So therefore, in this situation, it's perhaps less implausible. I hesitate to say plausible. But of course, we wouldn't get that, but we would get this. So we get that classical and quantum efficient computational power coincide, which may well be the case, because no one's proven that, but it isn't. And, you know, sometimes I think there's a good chance that it might well be the case. So. And indeed, for the latter conclusion, there's even more stuff we can throw in. This passage from nearest neighbor to next nearest neighbor, we don't even have to retain this massively strong notion of classical simulability, of computing the probabilities to exponential precision. It suffices much more feebly to sample the output distribution once to suitable accuracy. rather than doing this. So there's lots of extra ingredients you might throw in here to try and prove this result. And so you know, instead of thinking all the time that quantum computing is obviously more powerful than classical, it's sort of interesting, I think, to consider the opposite point of view sometimes too. And I think I'll finish there. Thank you.
Okay. So the Valiant match gates don't include the swap gate. Does that mean that the match gates are not classically universal?
Ah, yes, that's a good question. I'm not sure what their classical computational power is. It's not obvious to me that it equals P classically. Right. So it may be strictly weaker than P, which I think is probably plausible. I don't know, but other people might know. In which case, these results become even more remarkable because this use of the swap bridges not classical computing to full quantum computing, but something weaker than classical computing to full quantum computing. So, yeah, but it'd be interesting to know, like the analog of the theorem about stabilizing circuits, parity L and so on.
So I have a question regarding the Clifford group you mentioned before. So the representation of the Clifford algebra is unique up to those SON operations, right?
Yes.
So if you apply a Clifford group unitary now, then it maps a representation of the algebra to another representation of the algebra. But because they are unique, there should be an SON representation of that SON matrix which would do the same job, right? So it stands true that if the Clifford group is just a subset of those SON symmetries. Does it even give you anything new when you throw a Clifford group unitary set?
No, because the Clifford operations are not, they don't arise from quadratic Hamiltonians, I guess. Okay, so when you conjugate by a T, you're not conjugating by an exponential of a quadratic thing in the Clifford algebra.
But it maps the representation of the algebra to another representation of the algebra.
Yeah, but it's not me.
Yeah,
but it's not.
You don't map the representation to another.
Yeah, so it's unitarily equivalent representation, but it's not. In the linear, it's not in the SO2N sort of linear strand necessarily.
Can you say anything about the number of next nearest match gates you have to achieve universality? For example, is it sufficient to just have one and somehow move everything to this one?
Well, from sort of proof, there's only constant overhead. So, you know, if you've got a circuit of some size, the associated circuit of these JB things will be some constant
multiplicative factor, but I was wondering if you get constant additive factor instead.
I wouldn't think so. That would be really surprising, I think, that additive factor sort of vanish on you as the number gets bigger. I wouldn't expect that.
So, quick question, please. Last, then I was just wondering on the session of a coffee because we are 15 minutes late.
I just have a comment. You know, your Bayesian operators are in part physics or compressed matter theory of marijuana.
Oh, I know.
I know that, there's a free fermion Hamiltonian actually can appear in a second so-called Kidney part, in which we have a multi-spin in practice triangle, okay, and some new field theory on SAS actually the model can be reduced to free marijuana. So my question is that perhaps you are talking about here also has some mappings with exactly
Models. Okay, maybe. I mean, I don't know about that, but it certainly sounds plausible.
Okay, so let us calculate it again.